Hello and welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. Child and youth care in North America is often referred to as relational child and youth care. I was quite surprised to come across the Federation for Detached Youth Work. Detached? Why detached? Is relationship not the foundation of child and youth care practitioners? Why would anyone working with young people want to be detached? Once I looked into detached youth work, I discovered rather than being disconnected and aloof, relationship is in fact crucial. Detached youth work has pushed me to rethink some of the ways I engage in relationship as a CYC practitioner. Today, I'm speaking with Graham Tiffany. Graham has a background in youth work and community education. He is also currently the vice chair of the Federation for Detached Youth Work. I've asked him to speak with me today about detached youth work. Welcome to C2Y Podcast, Graham.
Yes, good morning from the UK.
Yes, I'm delighted you could join us from the UK. We have a bit of a staticky line, so hopefully it won't bother our listeners too much. So let's start with the obvious question. And for me, that question is, what is detached youth work?
I look back in my files. I've got many answers to this question, but one of my favorite definitions comes from a piece of research I was involved in nearly 10 years ago now, and many of us came together to discuss what this concept really meant. It's a typically floating concept, as a philosopher would say. It means different things to different people, but our deliberations at the time concluded that detached youth work works on and from young people's territory as determined by their definitions of space, needs, interests, concerns, and life and lifestyles. It endeavours to provide a broad-based, open-ended social education in which the interests, problems, and issues to be dealt with and the manner in which they are dealt with emerge from a dialogue between the young person and the youth worker. I've always thought this was a wonderful definition of the work that I've been involved in for many years, particularly because we can work with this constant territory. Many people will know that detached youth workers and their colleagues in other countries who generally go under the label of outreach workers or street workers, they inhabit public spaces, they go to the kind of physical places that young people gathering. But the idea that we can think of territory as something beyond that, as concepts of need as articulated and defined by young people, and indeed their interests, concerns and lifestyles, is something that's always attracted me to this this practice, particularly as I fear that in recent years this sense that young people can have the power and be accorded, celebrated, having the power to define their sense of these things is, in my judgment, being somewhat eroded.
And do you think that historically young people had more ability to define their territory, to use your word?
Well, it's certainly the case when we look back at the history of detached youth work to see that in its earliest days, the people who were involved in this kind of work were generally from faith-based organizations who were concerned for the welfare. And sometimes we also refer to the rescuing of the needy. But at the end of the Second World War, there was a sense that this view of people as in deficit needed some reorientation. And of course, you know we are working with young people who have many problems, but the sense that they are a problem is something that we've always contested as detached youth workers.
Right, so the shift from these are people who can perhaps access some resources that we have versus these are people who need to be rescued or saved or changed.
Precisely. Now, I said before that in many ways we might judge that there's a return to this historical position. But the sense that we can work in this democratic way where we can negotiate the kind of work that we're going to do, the kind of learning that's going to take place, has always been fundamental to my definition of what detached youth work is.
How do you see this returning to, and I've heard the term here in Canada called the rescue industry, which seems to pick up a little bit of what you were saying. How do you see this return to this historical position manifesting itself today?
I think that if we were to take a macro analysis of the political context and ideologies that inform social policy, it's clear, certainly clear to me, that we're shifting now from a what might be called a care agenda to a control agenda. And in this sense, you know, the language of protection is, again, I've got some philosophical background. I'm fascinated by the language of social policy. You know, I can quote an American sociologist who talked about a good deal of tyranny goes under the name of protection. And I find it fascinating to understand protection as, if you like, one side of a two-sided coin, in which the other side is very much something to do with empowerment and autonomy. If we go in one direction to protect young people, it's implicit that we have to control their behaviours for their benefit. And yet if we go the other way, of course, we might take risks with their protection. But there's something fundamental in the definition that I gave you, that we're working with people as creators of their good lives and contributors to wider society. So I see now in policy a disregard now for this history of negotiation as to how we might work and how we might collaborate with the young people that we work with towards one that seeks more and more to activate them in particular ways. That's a quote from a German academic called Axel Kohl, who says that youth work is really being replaced by what he calls the activation agenda, where its focus is very much on employability, and this disregards a whole series of other elements of life that for detached youth workers are intrinsic to a holistic regime.
You use words like collaboration, you use words like engagement, activation. I'm still a bit tripped up on the phrase detached. Could you just explain that for me before we move on?
Yes, you know, again, I think it's important to review the history of this practice, which is more than 150 years old in this country. Certainly one of the first countries in the world to develop this way of working. Historically, we often talked about young people as the unattached. There was a very famous book in the 1950s that was entitled The Unattached. And in this sense, young people were viewed as themselves unattached to institutions, to youth organizations, often to schools, families, and beyond. Our reflections at that in that period of time concluded that this was a problematic description of young people. It was, in a sense, always to put them in deficit, always to objectify them as people who were judged as problems, delinquents, gangsters, drug addicts, these kinds of conceptions. So the shift to the concept of detached was really to challenge the sense that we were describing young people as unattached. And we have said from the very earliest days that it is the workers who are detached, not the young people. This is a reflection of the workers' capacity to be mobile in public space and in other environments in which young people might move. But it's also a sense that they're detached from institutional framework, the very institutional framework that may well have created regimes of exclusion that have affected the lives of those young people. So it is ourselves as workers that seek to detach ourselves from the kind of things going on in society that are essentially a problem for the young people.
What I'm hearing you say is that the framing of youth as, or young people as, unattached, really it was a definition or a label of disconnected from society, culture, as we want to construct it. Detached youth work is taking that position of, we are not going to be attached to social constructions which are about oppressing or defining or controlling young people. We're going to be detached from that notion of youth work.
Yes, precisely. You know, the sense that we can stand alongside young people and negotiate their place in the world in this kind of mutual way is really quite important to young people who are often negatively affected by the institutional constraints that you draw attention to. There are many, many good public services, but you should always question their accessibility. Very typical young person, somebody who's lacking in support from others, finds it difficult to navigate, for example, the health service. They'll have to register and make an appointment, vetted and analysed, and they have their lives looked into, and you know, this material subsequently goes onto extraordinary numbers of databases. And all these conspire to creating what I want to call high threshold practices. And of course, this is very much the history of not only detached youth work in Britain, but street work and outreach work all across the world. We are trying to work in a low threshold way, trying to identify the things that make it difficult for young people to access the services to which they're entitled. And if that means that we are...
Sorry, I missed that last point. So you talk about high threshold practices being difficult to access. There's a high demand on the young person, and detached youth work works from a low threshold practice, which makes it very, very accessible and easy for young people to access. Could you continue from there?
Yes, absolutely. I think we can use some examples here. If I want to go to the dentist, then generally I'm going to have to go to the dentist between, let's say, 9 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, maybe we can say that for most people that's reasonable, but we have to imagine that there are those for whom the times of these services can represent some kind of barrier. So it's very typical that detached youth workers and their street work counterparts will work at whatever hours is necessary in order to get that engagement with young people. You'll find street workers working often in the early hours of the morning, simply because that is the time that young people are present. But we're trying to take services to people in a manner that make them as accessible as possible. We're trying to reflect on those thresholds that make it difficult. Often public services have what we might call gatekeepers, and if the gatekeeper is a particular kind of person, it might be a person of a different colour from myself as a young person. These subtleties can make it very difficult for young people to engage with these services. And of course, the concept of outreach, if we reflected on that for a moment, is literally to take the services out into these environments. I work a lot with people who work with homeless populations, people who are street homeless, perhaps who've got problems with drugs. And it's a simple idea. You know, if these young people and adults are often not accessing public welfare services, so we need to take these services to those people in the environments in which they're comfortable to use them. Often young people fear being identified, accessing these services. So we might need to think also about delivering these services in environments that are anonymous and, you know, in quiet places and small places that simply make it more comfortable for young people to be involved.
I'm intrigued with the idea of providing services, and I'm intrigued because when I looked at some of the literature that you suggested that I read to familiarize myself, and for example, in the International Guide on the Methodology of Street Work Throughout the World, which you were a reviewer on, there's a series of 5 stages that are identified in street work. And support and intervention is the last stage. The first stage is studying the setting. The second is presence, being in the setting. The third is identification of the worker to the people in the setting. The fourth stage is forming relationship. And finally, it's support and intervention. And one of the things that kept coming up for me as I was reading about detached youth work is detached youth workers, their primary objective is not necessarily to provide service, unlike outreach workers, I think, in North America, where our position is directly to provide services to these young people, and that's our sole purpose. There seems to be a bit of a different quality to detached youth work. Could you walk us through those five stages, studying present identification, relationship, and then support intervention a little bit, and how that fits into the larger project?
Yes, I'd be pleased to do that. I think I would start from agreeing with you absolutely that this is not simply an activity based on providing services to people. You know, it's absolutely essential in our identity that we describe ourselves as educators. You see all of this within a paradigm of socio-educative paradigm. People who are involved in welfare-based activities, but fundamentally, you know, we see ourselves as educators. We see ourselves as people who work with young people in order that they can develop the knowledge, skills, and attitudes in order to be able to live a good life in its widest sense. So in order to be able to do this, we say implicitly that we have to have a really, really very good and detailed understanding of the context in which young people live. So, you know, ideally, and I have to say this has been challenged in recent years, we would spend quite a long time understanding those communities, understanding the support structures, understanding the assets within those communities as much as the problems within them. We talk about, it's a military term that many of us are uncomfortable with, but reconnaissance and then community profiling. And this lays the kind of foundations for making contact with young people. I could reflect on colleagues from Pamplona in northern Spain who will quite literally not make the first move in making contact with young people. They call it the request. They will be present in these environments to such an extent that they become seen as fixtures in these environments. People who perhaps have done no more than smile and make a friendly nod. But when a young person makes a request of a street worker like this, there is a fundamental recognition that this demonstrates that that young person wants this relationship to happen, so they can always have confidence that the thing that he asked for is truly something that is wanted and needed by that young person. And that fascinates me because generally now, especially in times of austerity and efficiency and effectiveness, there's a move to make these interventions sooner and sooner and sooner on the basis that, in a sense, we know what young people need. And that's deeply problematic because, again, our history demonstrates that we've always wanted to have conversations and dialogues about what young people need and want. I've often said that young people's wants are expressed needs. It's interesting to reflect, of course, on our experience as youth workers, that maybe we do know things about what young people need that perhaps they're not conscious of at that time. But in that messy world of conversation and dialogue, we can get to a point where there's an agreement on the things that we should do in meeting those needs. And when there's a connection there, we're tapping into the intrinsic motivation of young people. And I fear that more and more the policy agendas become based on extrinsic motivation. We're trying to, as I said before, activate young people into particular behaviours. But that's very much a sense of the relationship-based context in which the support and intervention and development of those relationships can take place. But I do also want to make this wider point that we've never, ever seen that we could work with young people in isolation from their communities. We want to support communities in supporting the youth within those communities. Sometimes that's as simple as trying to encourage adults and others to be a bit more tolerant of young people, to sensitize them to the social realities of the lives of those young people. That's a community development model. And recently I've been looking at whether or not there has been, in a sense, the death of community. And I very much think that we need to revisit and re-celebrate our community work past, because, again, there's a complexity here that's essential for good practice.
So bringing the community that surrounds the young people that are not explicitly part of the young people, but are part of that young person's territory.
Absolutely. And I want to go further and to say that This should not be seen simplistically as a friendly neighbour giving support on a philanthropic basis to a young person, because our research and our experiences show us that often it's simplistic to think that adults are motivated to be involved in these, in this case, intergenerational programs, simply because they wish to do something that's that helps young people. I can reflect on a project I worked on recently in which elderly people participated in a project with young people. But when we asked those elderly people what their motivations were, we found that many of them had they were detached from young people in general. And now it's very common that older people's children live often very far away from the communities in which they live, which means that they may well not see their grandchildren beyond once or twice a year. And this is a kind of an extraordinary reality about the world as it is today. And when we realised that these people were involved in these projects, which at first glance were simply to help young people, when we realised that they were there because they had their own needs, their own social needs to have a life in which they were young people. And I asked them permission to speak to the young people about this testimony. And of course they agreed. But when we told young people that their presence was something that they could contribute to the good lives of older residents, this really had a transformative effect on how they viewed their lives and the contribution that they might make in their communities. Because as I said, generally we see young people in deficit. These young people became very enthusiastic about other things that they could do to support older people. Things that they could teach them, for example. I mean, the classic one, of course, is navigating new social media. And it was fascinating to watch young people enthusiastically setting up training courses and being the teachers of older people. And I think this is the new world in which we see young people as people who we might teach things, but equally they may indeed teach us others. And this mutuality, this collaboration between the generations is a very positive step in the development of strong and cohesive communities.
Certainly, I'm quite struck as you say that around some of the literature around resilience or trauma or any of that body of work that looks at, you know, beyond social support, having the person who has experienced the challenges give back to their community has a more healing, for lack of a better term, effect than even receiving services. And making that shift from young people as needers of services to providers of services is such a fundamental shift, and takes the idea of engagement into a whole new direction.
I think that's true, but I always caution this, if I might call it, therapeutic turn. I've got a particular interest in the ethnographies of social policy and the language of social policy, and it's my view that increasingly they are psychologized, and the problems that young people have because of these narratives increasingly seem to be entirely a product of their own dispositions and choices. So I contest some of these concepts such as resilience. I contest some of the concepts such as self-esteem and well-being. I think they, in a sense, may even have a deliberate intention of detaching us from some of the social causes of the problems and challenges that young people face, which is precisely why a moment ago I talked about whether or not there was a death community work and community development strategies in which we might engage not just with the personal dimensions of young people's problems, but also the cultural, community, and structural causes of those problems as well.
There's a significant move right now in North America in particular around what's being defined as CYC practitioners, child and youth care practitioners. And there's significant movement right now to professionalize the work. And so there's a variety of bodies that are working to certify, credentialize, professionalize. And the agenda of a great deal of these bodies have an explicitly therapeutic or treatment focus. Ontario Association of Child and Youth Care Counselors, the National Association of Child and Youth Care, Canadian Association of Child and Youth Care, the National Certification Project in North America. What do you see as the risk to young people by framing our work as explicitly therapeutic or a treatment focus? You talk about some of your caution around language and the dissolution of community, perhaps. Beyond that, what do you think the risk is to the young people that we work with?
I think the risks are great. I think at this time in the development of our work, it's really quite critical to examine what we take the concept of the professional to be. I distinguish, I hope, very clearly in the things that I say and do between professionalism and what I would want to call professionalization. The latter, as you talk about, the tendency always to credentialize and create these kind of mystical languages. I was struck by Putnam's book on social capital, Bowling Alone, and the relationship, the degradation of social capital in line with the amount of lawyers in society. I don't think there's any other profession that so extraordinarily develops its own alien language to feather its own nest. So I want to revisit the concept of the professional. I want to say that perhaps detached youth workers are truly a wonderful example of being professional, not in the sense of expertise, of kind of having the possession of a body of knowledge that nobody else can access, but they are experts in process. And I theorize that the expert of the future will be much more characterized by having democratic dispositions. An example of that would be, and it's my experience, younger doctors who really do think it's a reasonable thing to ask patients what they think's happening in their own health. You know, this is a break from a tradition where the doctor was an expert and the font of all knowledge about ill health. And if we apply the same kind of metaphor to a world in which we work with people as educators and social professionals, then it's the same. You know, we need a different relationship. In the former, we see this historical culture of the doctor always knows best. And, you know, especially now where we can access knowledge through the internet, I think it's fascinating to see patients researching their own symptoms and conditions and challenging doctors. And I see that as a good thing. I see that as a potential for empowerment of people. And I think that if we can view the professional of the future as soon as possible, actually, in these terms, we could be onto some interesting and progressive territory. So I want to, as they say, big up the concept of the, ironically perhaps, the semi-professional as the professional of the future. Semi-professional in the sense that we do listen and we do engage with what I call knowledge on the ground, the knowledge that comes through the experience of living the lives that many of the young people and the wider communities in which we work have through bitter experience often. And many of the answers and solutions to these social problems are contained in that body of knowledge.
One of the pressures, I think, around professionalization as opposed to professionalism has to do with funding, austerity. So for example, there was recently, I saw a posting here in Ontario for 35 new street outreach positions, and it's funded to explicitly deal with violence, gang violence. So there's a very clear agenda from the funders as to the role of these youth outreach workers. What is your relationship to other people who work with young people? So I'm thinking of hospitals, I'm thinking of police, I'm thinking of schools, I'm thinking of government bodies. what's the relationship between detached youth work and these other infrastructure programs specifically designed for young people?
I think there are issues in your question for me. There's a question about the concept of partnership, and there's a question about the concept of the, what I would call, the issue-led work. Take the first one. Good detached youth workers, they epitomize what it is to work in partnership. You know, I think about the many, many years I worked in this way, and I always took great pride in saying to young people, you know, I don't know, but I know somebody who does. And to be a bridge between young people and other opportunities and services, the very bridge that's missing sometimes, which is why I make my earlier comments about accessibility, was always something that I recognised as being very valuable to young people. Now, again, if I might be historical for a moment, I would say that these behaviours exemplified what I would call informal partnership. We were deeply active in seeking out others who, by working with them, we judged that we could create benefits for young people. And of course, that material, those activities were very well researched, but the conclusion that workers should work in formal partnerships was, for me, a strange one. Because what we've seen in practice is that when you formalise these partnership arrangements, typically that would mean that the detached youth worker then becomes part of a formal team, perhaps with child protection officer, perhaps also with police officers and the like, perhaps with teachers. Then in those environments, it's very typical that the detached youth worker becomes what I call the minority partner. And I have to say that a few years ago, I wrote a book on the basis of some extensive research about detached youth work. And there were more than several voices that said to me they had been in these partnership arrangements where they were told by what I now call the majority partners, you are in partnership with us, so you will do this. It struck me as being a little bit ironic in terms of the concept of partnership. I was hopefully brave enough to say that this perhaps represented what I call the tyranny of partnership. So, you know, that stuff really needs looking at, and I absolutely accept the value of working in partnership, but we have to find a way of liberating the individual partners to work in a way that reflects their principles, traditions, histories and knowledge. And you know, what tends to happen with detached youth workers is that because they're identified as what I call practitioners with access, perhaps the only people who've got relationship with the young people that so many other services want to engage with, they're simply given a list of things to solve. And of course, that takes me to the second point. Violence, put that on the list. Teenage pregnancy, put that on the list. Drug misuse, put that on the list. And then the work becomes issue-led. Go out there and fix this problem. My colleagues in France, somewhat ironically, I don't know whether you've ever been or any of your listeners have ever been to France, but you'll find a do-it-yourself supermarket there called Bricolage. And the symbol for this is a guy who sports a spanner in one hand and a drill in the other, and he's the character who can fix anything. And with irony, of course, French street workers, they call themselves "Je suis Monsieur Bricolage," because, of course, they are asked to fix all these social problems. And I want to say that this is typically to fail to see the wood for the trees. When we look very closely at the practices of detached youth workers, they are working in that negotiated, democratic way. They're constantly improvising. They're engaging with all sorts of other actors in that community to benefit young people. They've got this emphasis on education. And it's messy. It's messy in a wonderfully chaotic but positive way. My own academic research is about the value of uncertainty in these practices. And when people fail to recognise that it's the process that gets the good outcomes, what happens in policy is that the workers are simply given a list of things to achieve in a certain amount of time. And unfortunately, I judge, and I've been writing recently, that this is less efficient rather than more efficient. And we see these behaviours, I suspect they came on the wind from America like so many other things, the perverse effects of performativity when workers are expected to engage with X number of young people in a specific amount of time. It's very typical, I suppose, pressure that they will go and seek out young people who are quite simply easier to work with. And I've concluded a long time ago that that simply exacerbates the social exclusion of the most needy. And that's ironic when the policy agenda is designed to help them most.
Yes, ironic indeed. As we wrap up this interview, there's a key point. In the introduction, I talked about, you know, rethinking my own ideas of relationship. And one of the key aspects of detached youth work is this notion of volunteerism, that the only sanction, if you will, that a detached youth worker can give is to withdraw their services. And often in CYC practice, we talk about engagement and having young people buy into the programs or do what the CYC practitioner would like them to do. You've written that in order for young people to be engaged, the youth worker needs to be engaging. And I see this as somewhat of a shift from labeling the young person as not engaged to identifying the youth worker as not engaging. Can you talk a little bit as we wrap up about the role of volunteerism in detached youth work?
Yes, again, once again, there's lots of different ways of responding to this question. Let me pick two or three. I'd want to say that something quite important to me and to my colleagues about the notion of voluntary association. I reflected a moment ago about the shift from system based on tapping into the intrinsic motivations, interests, dreams perhaps of young people to one that seeks to activate them on the basis of extrinsic motivation, which of course goes under the name of coercion. Now that's quite important, because we have there this real commitment to find the things that young people tick, find the things motivate them, because we know that when we can get hold of that kind of source, it's the catalyst, it's the engine for, you know, for transforming the lives of the young people that we work with, but also the wider communities. I often talk about detached youth workers being deprived of a set of cards. If we imagine we have cards in both our hands, in one hand, people in institutions, they have, let's call them what they are, they're the power cards. In a school, we can put young people into some kind of exclusion unit. We can put them in detention. We can punish them. Other services may say, well, you know, because of your behaviours, your attitudes, we're not going to give you that service. These are the power cards. And the detached youth worker, because of where they work principally, they're deprived of these cards, and we celebrate not having these cards. So we have to use the cards in our other hand. These are the cards of respect, these are the cards of negotiation, these are the cards of subtlety and complexity, judgment making. And, you know, I've started to do some work with teachers, and I say this to them: if you could imagine the walls of your classroom falling down and young people were free to walk away as they are in my life in the street, would you work differently? And of course, there's always the same conclusion. They know that they would have to. And this teaches us that we have to look to this other hand of cards that is so routinely disregarded as important, the democratic cards, because that's the way to get good engagement. That's the way to support powerful and good learning. And I invite all professionals in all public services to imagine what their work would be like if they were deprived of the power cards. It's fascinated me for now more than 25 years that I can stand in the street with young people and they choose to be there. Just the reality is that at any moment I know they can just turn and simply walk away. And that for me is something that I celebrate, because I know that when they're present, it's something that is working for them and something that they and value in. And again, I offer that as a stimulus for others to think about how they work with young people and others in their communities.
Graham, Tiffany, I think that's a beautiful way to wrap up my questions. It really does give us all something to think about as somebody who continues to do youth work, as somebody who teaches in a formal education setting. It forces me to examine how I use and don't use the power cards and how I use and don't use the engagement cards. So I think it's a wonderful. You've given us a lot of things to think about. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up, Graham?
Well, I welcome the opportunity to talk to you, and I wish you well with this project. I think you've got something very interesting here. I think it speaks to the social that is so important in my view of what good work looks like. I've reflected, I hope, on what I think is a social policy agenda that increasingly individualizes our interventions, and the good future for us all is to remember that we all need to work in a social way, because without the social, we don't have the moral, we don't have the ethical, and actually we don't have the political or the democratic. All fundamental change in society is going to happen. So I hope lots of people listen to these musings, and I will certainly do my best to encourage people to do the same.
Thank you very much. And I would encourage people to look at two things, to look at your website, which is Graham Tiffany, and Graham is spelled G-R-A-E-M-E, and then Tiffany, TIFFANY.co.uk, and then, of course, the Federation for Detached Youth Work is another site that I would highly encourage people to look at, and I'll put links to both of those on the podcast site for anybody who wants to link directly. Graham Tiffany, thank you very, very much for your time and your musings and thoughts and wisdom on detached youth work.
My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.